This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. When the Department of Justice issued its groundbreaking report about injustices at the Ferguson Police Department in Missouri in the wake of Michael Brown's killing, a major revelation was how legal fines and tickets are impacting poor residents. But this is not just a problem relegated to Ferguson. Although debtors' prisons are technically outlawed, we have recreated a patchwork system of fines and fees in the United States today that disproportionately impacts poor people and amounts to a modern-day debtors' prison. A new book by my guest Alexis Harris likens this contemporary system of court fines and fees to Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, when restitution is demanded in the form of something so essential that it would kill the person from whom it is extracted, a pound of flesh. Alexis Harris is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Washington, and her book is called A Pound of Flesh, Monetary Sanctions as Punishment for the Poor. Welcome to the program, Alexis.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, we live in a very complicated setup in the United States where there are different courts at different levels. We've got our federal system, we've got our state system, we've got our county system, we've got our city systems, and they differ depending on where you are. So for the purposes of your book, explain the kind of jurisdiction that we would be examining, that you examined. Which sort of spaces did you examine where such fines and fees, as I mentioned, impact poor people disproportionately?
Right. So there are so many different layers of monetary sanctions, the fines, the fees, the surcharges, the assessments, from juvenile court to misdemeanors and traffic court to felony and federal court. So for the book, I decided just to narrow down what I could handle, and that's the felony superior court. So these are the state superior courts where people are charged and convicted and sentenced of the more serious types of offenses.
And so would it be fair to say that you can somewhat extrapolate the experiences in those courts to lower courts, to municipal courts too, that similar types of things do happen depending, of course, upon where you go?
You know, I think the problem with monetary sanctions is it's so variable. So we can't say necessarily that exactly what I studied in my five counties in Washington State happens on the municipal level. We do know that Ferguson, what happened at Ferguson, the municipal level, is not an anomaly for the United States, that what's happening there is happening in other jurisdictions. So I think it's safe to say that given the state-level statute that allows court officials at every jurisdictional level to impose fines and fees and surcharges, we can say that there is, with some variability, there are still dramatic problems and consequences related to the imposition of fines and fees, and that people are being incarcerated for their inability to make payments.
Okay, so let's talk specifics. What are the sorts of infractions that you studied in Washington State, in the specific, these specific five counties, that people are punished for through fees, through fines, through payment of, you know, money that is usually scarce for them?
Right. So in Washington State, at the felony level, anyone convicted of a felony has a mandatory minimum fine and fee of $600. We have a $500 victim penalty assessment, regardless of if there's a victim, and a $100 DNA assessment. So $600 is the mandatory minimum for each felony in Washington State. And then there's discretionary fines and fees that can be assessed as well. So there's $200 that can be assessed in court costs. There's a variable range that can be assessed for a public defender, for the use of a public defender, one that you couldn't afford, but one that was appointed to you. So in one of my counties, regularly people would be assessed $450 for that public defender. There's also a $100 annual collection surcharge. So any open account, if someone does not have the ability to pay off their fine and fee from the day of sentence, they will be charged annually $100 for that collection process. And then in addition, 12% interest accrues on the initial principal. So when I studied the data I had from 2004 through 2008, the average felony sentence, fiscal sentence, was about $1,300. More recent data show it's about $1,000, but that's per felony conviction.
Now, you mentioned public defenders. Isn't the whole point that if somebody is too poor to afford to pay for their own lawyer, that they get a publicly appointed lawyer? How is it that they're charged $450?
Right. The Supreme Court, Gideon, established the right of every person who was being accused and who might face incarceration to have a public defender appointed to them for their trial or for their adjudication. Nowhere in the Supreme Court did it say who was going to pay for it. So more recently, states have been turning towards the defendant, saying you have to pay for the use of this public defender. In one of the courts that I made observations in, regularly there were two, and this was out of the five counties I observed, there were only two public defenders who would say regularly upon conviction, and their defendant would be sentenced $450. They would say, Your Honor, I just met my client yesterday, or I really didn't spend this much time on the case. Do you think you could reduce the cost of the public defense fee? And then maybe it would be reduced to $200. But so it's completely surprising. But nowhere does it say in any case law that the government should be responsible for paying for that defense attorney.
So it's something we just take for granted.
Right.
So I wanted to sort of step back and bring up the analogy that you bring up in the beginning of your book, that the name of your book is based on a pound of flesh. This idea from Shakespearean times that Shakespeare depicted in his play, The Merchant of Venice, that restitution to kind of, pay for one's crime can be something that is so painful that it literally is something that could kill you. That a pound of when you extract a pound of flesh from somebody, you're essentially undermining their ability to live. Expand on that a little bit more, why you chose that as a title of your book.
Well, so there's two reasons. One is that actually this was a term that was used by a prosecutor that I was talking to about fines and fees. And he used this term pound of flesh as a sort of a example of getting more retribution, getting more, sticking it to the defendant, giving that defendant more punishment. So that came from the field, from doing data collection. But it's also it's this what I talk about are LFOs, legal financial obligations, or monetary sanctions. And it's in addition to restitution. So it's not just payments towards victims, but it's payment to fines based on the offense that you are convicted of. It's user fees. Costs that are being charged to defendants for being processed through the court system. It's surcharges, sometimes surcharges and assessments that are completely unrelated to your case. They go to brain injury funds or to state transportation funds or to clean election campaigns. So surcharges and assessments are completely unrelated to what you did. And then there's interest and collection charges. So this bucket of money that's being assessed to disproportionately poor people creates this burden, a financial burden. It creates a tether. They're tethered to the criminal justice system for the remainder of their life until they can pay off the debt. And it creates an emotional burden that impacts their ability to function in life.
And so basically, you can have a single fine or a fee also kind of blow up into something even bigger. If you can't pay something to begin with, say, you're being charged $500 for something, you don't have $500 in the bank. What happens? Is the court going to set up a payment plan for you, or are they just going to add another fine?
The courts will set up, they're supposed to set up payment plans. And that payment could be $20 a month or $50 a month. The problem is that people get these bills, and every month they'll make the $20 payment, but each month it goes up because
So it's
you'll.
like a credit card bill,
Exactly. They
basically.
can never see themselves getting out of that debt. And
Wow.
so it feels like a literal pound of flesh. They have nothing left to give. They have no money. We know that people who make contact with the criminal justice system are disproportionately underly formally educated. So they're high school dropouts. Typically, they are underemployed or unemployed. They have severe mental health issues, drug and alcohol addiction, a host of problems. And then they come and they get a felony conviction and then receive the related collateral consequences from lack of housing and bans on receiving state assistance. And then we saddle them with this legal debt, which really inhibits their ability to move forward with their lives.
And so the very idea that this is supposed to be a punishment for some crime that you might commit, the punishment itself makes it less likely for you to be able to rehabilitate yourself because all of a sudden you're burdened with so much more debt and you might have turned to crime to begin with because you didn't have access to a decent job.
Right, as some of the people I interviewed said, I interviewed this one woman that was so powerful. She said, I know I could go She was in the sex industry, and she said, I know I could go turn some tricks and get some money to make my minimum payment, but I don't want to do that, and I know the state doesn't want me to do that. These folks who are experiencing this debt have very little alternatives for raising money. Even $20, which might not seem that much to some people, even $20 is an insurmountable cost for them when they're choosing to buy prescriptions or choosing to buy healthy food or trying to take care of their children. And this isn't, sometimes I get a lot of pushback. We'll say, well, if you do the crime, you pay the fine or you pay the penalty. And at the felony level, which I think it's so important to talk about, is that these people are doing time. They're going to jail. They're going to prison. They're on community service. They're on community supervision. They have to do drug and alcohol treatment, which they have to pay for. They have to pay for their supervision of probation. So they're getting punished. And my book really raises the question is, do we need an additional punishment? Do we need to add this financial burden to people who can't pay it? They can never be held accountable to fulfill this punishment because of their poverty.
Now, is it just felonies? What about even at the level of misdemeanors? How do fines and fees get tacked on to poor people who might be disproportionately targeted by the police because of their race or class or both?
Right.
Does that level of crime, quote unquote, also bear or come with this financial burden?
Right, definitely. And this is what we saw in Ferguson, and I think this is what we're seeing in other municipalities. And I have a current research study where we're actually looking in 8 states and looking at the state level, the superior level, felony level, and the misdemeanor level to try and figure out the extent of the problem and how they might compare between felony and misdemeanor courts. But clearly, this happens. I mean, you can get, so I use the example in the book of myself, and I was doing, maybe this was 7 or 8 years ago, I was pulled over for a speeding ticket, and I was speeding, not intentionally, but I was speeding. And the nice officer spent more time explaining to me how I could go online and apply for a deferred finding. And so I pay my base fine, which was like $150 or something, and then I would pay to enter into a deferred finding. And so with this knowledge and because I had the means, of course I went in and did this, and I didn't receive a traffic ticket for the next year, and so it didn't affect my insurance. My insurance rate was not notified and wasn't raised. But had I not had the information, had I not had the financial means, maybe I wouldn't have paid the ticket, and that means then I would have eventually lost my driver's license, and then if I was driving, I could have been pulled over by a police officer and taken to jail for what we call in Washington DWLS-3, driving with a license suspended in the third degree. This happens across Washington State. It happens in multiple states nationally where people who are poor receive traffic tickets. They're unable to make the payment, and then they end up literally in jail because of their poverty.
And then how is this different from debtor's prison?
Right. So we have the state Supreme Court, Bearden v. Georgian in 1983, which established this legal concept, willful nonpayment. And so it was Danny Bearden. He was convicted of a crime. And the prosecutor said that he wasn't making payment. He paid partially, and the judge and they wanted to incarcerate him. And the judge said that you didn't make the payment, you will be incarcerated. And the United States Supreme Court said you have to have an individualized assessment that determines whether or not this person chose willfully to not make a payment. They had the means and didn't make a payment. The problem, as I've observed in counties in Washington State, is the ways in which judges are interpreting this concept of willful nonpayment. So some judges would look at women's manicures and say, how much did you pay for that? I saw a judge ask a woman, who did your tattoo and how much did you pay for it?
Wow.
Prosecutors will ask people how much they spend on their packs of cigarettes and look at that money as money that could have been spent on their legal financial obligation and say, well, it was willful. You had the means and you chose not to do it, so we can therefore incarcerate you.
I mean, the level of, and you use this term, I think, quite aptly, paternalism,
yeah,
built into the system also relies on judiciary discretion, right?
Right.
So this is based on a judge who may have no real sense of what it's like to live as a poor person, except through what he or she sees in their courts every day, and applies their own implicit biases or stereotypes to the people coming before them, and decides that it's in their power to punish somebody who might choose to spend their money on a pack of cigarettes rather than pay a fine.
Right. I mean, that's the big problem. I think this is where the solution comes in, is that the state statutes are so ambiguous and unclear and provide judges with so much discretion to sentence people to these ridiculous fines and fees, and to interpret whether or not it was willful or not, or to interpret whether or not the person has the ability to pay. So then the solution becomes at the state level to have statutes that protect the rights of poor people, that say judges must make an individualized assessment upon sentencing of this person's ability to make payments. And then once, if a financial amount is sentenced, judges must make individualized assessments and look at financial information to see, does this person truly have a regular means of income that can be paid monthly towards their legal financial obligations? So our judges, our decision makers with vast amounts of discretion, need more guidance from the state legislature in terms of what we as citizens expect for them to do in the courtroom.
Well, that's one way, but what about just even assessing the ridiculous amounts of fees? You mentioned earlier that there are fees that are not even related to what a person might be convicted of in terms of the crime, that are simply used to fund certain aspects of the state. Now, this doesn't make any sense. Shouldn't we be looking at some parts of these fines and fees as a regressive tax on poor people? That the cities, states, counties realize, oh, we need money for certain programs, we don't have it. Well, let's just add a fine to everybody who gets convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor of this class, et cetera.
And that's exactly what's happening, is that we've seen in the last about 16 to 20 years, in the late 90s, early 2000s, where I argue states are realizing we can't afford mass conviction and incarceration the way we've been doing it. We've had this ramp up of the number of people we've been bringing through the criminal justice system and housing in jails and prisons, and we can't afford it. And so the state legislature is saying, oh, it makes sense, let's add this to a fine or to a fee for defendants who are costing. So logically it might make sense, but in reality it's a taxation on the poor. It's a regressive system that the citizenry can't afford, and they're not really paying into what I think state policymakers and court officials think that they're receiving. I mean, I've been saying this for a while, is that if you go and ask a policymaker or a clerk that manages these programs in county courthouses, how much money they're bringing in and how much money they're spending on doing collections and incarceration, no one can tell you this. No one in any jurisdiction will be able to show you the numbers, because they're not doing it. They're not doing the analysis. But it's more so this rhetoric about punishment and, oh, it makes sense financially to do it, but there's no hard evidence. And that's really what I tried to do in the book, is document this, and with my future project is really try and figure out how much are jurisdictions spending, how much are they recouping, and what are the human and the fiscal costs to individuals and to society for doing this type of sentence.
And this also fits within, we talked about paternalism earlier, this also fits within this narrative of personal responsibility that becomes this very uniquely, cruelly American framework for how we view poor people. You're poor because you deserve to be poor. If you worked harder, you'd be rich. If you commit a crime, you pay a fine. And if you don't, you have to be held personally responsible. Just kind of undermining and not accounting for the kind of status and the full context of people's lives.
Right. The American criminal justice system, the ways in which we've used social control, is exceptional. There's no other system like this. I mean, we are the best country in terms of the way that we surveillance, that we mark, we incarcerate, we criminalize the poor and the racially marginalized in this country. And we do it with this rhetoric of paternalism, that we're doing it to protect and to help rehabilitate these so-called offenders. We create this system, this financial system of accountability, where each payment, court officials and even policymakers I talk to, describe this a payment as remorse, that they don't anticipate someone's going to be able to pay this all off, but we're giving them a system where they can make a payment and demonstrate their remorse and their step towards rehabilitation. It's very paternalistic.
Right. We're just doing it for their own good.
Right. And their protection within the system. But all of the findings in my book, in terms of the consequences for families and community building, employment and housing, all of this runs counter to what sociological and criminological research finds, that people need to have healthy, stable lives, formal relationships, with partners and family members to desist from offending. So it is this classic American culture about punishment.
Meanwhile, corporations who routinely break laws and who are legally seen in our legal system as persons are often fined, if at all, just tiny, tiny portions that barely impact their bottom lines and are often simply seen as a cost of doing business. It's really remarkable. And this is a very little discussed issue and aspect of our criminal justice system. So Alexis, I want to thank you so much for drawing attention to it. I look forward to your next book.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Alexis Harris is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Washington. We've been discussing her new book, A Pound of Flesh, Monetary Sanctions as Punishment for the Poor. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.